Hi, everybody. It's really great to be here with you. There's so much happening within the world. And I think one of the things that COVID-19 reminds us is how important it is to be prepared for whatever's going on. Now, you guys are all in a very good situation because being on here today means that you've already done a lot of your planning. But one of the things that we like to do at our law office is make sure that people are kept up to date. So these client update seminars are something that we've done for many years at this point in time. We often respond to law changes and we want to be able to get information out to anybody so they can think about how does it impact their specific situation. We always are happy to do review appointments with people to discuss your individual situation. So I'm excited to be able to talk to you today. We had already planned to do this, as Matt had said, and we've made some changes to it and added some things because of COVID-19. So I'm happy that you're willing to join us. I know for some people, the technology is very new. Zoom's something that I've used for many years, and it's something that we are using right now to meet with clients. We also are using phone calls, and it's going okay. It's different, but it's okay. And we want to make sure that we're available to you to keep you up to date. So, as many of you guys know, many of you have personally worked with me. I am the founder of the firm. I work in both the Williamsport and State College offices. I'm a certified elder law attorney, and most of my practice focuses on wealth protection planning. Helping people worry about what happens if they pass away, or they get sick, or they get Alzheimer's. And I also bring to that a lot of income tax and other tax planning. So most of you that were on here have worked with me and will continue to work with me. But at the office, we do work as a team together, as a group of people, so that we can bring you the best service that we possibly can. I am still the author of the Pennsylvania Trust Guide that many attorneys use throughout our whole state. And so that's always a great thing because our trusts are very individualized and tailored to what you would want. And that's one of the things, whenever we think about our review appointment, it's always a good thing to look back through our trusts and say, did these really say what we wanted them to say? And even if they do say what we wanted them to, have things changed? Have grandchildren gotten older? Have children gotten older? Do we feel differently about things? One of my new passions and focus of my firm and what I do is I spend a lot of time with helping people who are living with Alzheimer's or a caregiver with somebody with Alzheimer's or dementia. And we've written some shooks about that, short, helpful books. And so we always have available at our firm things that we've written. We believe really strongly that educating our clients and helping them to better understand and feel comfortable with their choices and their options is really, really important. I'll turn it over to Landon to talk a little bit about his background, and then I'll pick it back up about long-term care planning. Landon?
All right, thank you, Julie. So I saw some familiar faces in the group earlier, but so for those who do know me, good to see you again. Wish we could do this in more personal circumstances, but we're making the best of what we have right now. But for those of you that don't know me, my name is Landon Hodges. I'm a transplant from North Carolina. Been up here for about 3 years. And as you see that on the screen, did all of my education in North Carolina at Wake Forest University in Elon School of Law. It started out as an intern here, really just with a willingness to learn the ropes and learn something new and figure it out and work wherever I fit in best in the practice. And what that's turned into since then is a primary focus on wealth protection and tax planning. But I also help families with long-term care planning. And then also anytime litigation services are needed or there's anything that might need court intervention, I'm usually one of the go-to points of contact for that. I currently reside in Jersey Shore, Pennsylvania, so you'll see me at either the Williamsport or the State College offices. I position myself in the middle because I'm kind of back and forth. Again, I kind of practice wherever I'm needed and then go wherever I need to go. So you might see me anywhere there. But now I was originally from Mount Airy, North Carolina, which many of you probably don't recognize, but you would recognize it as Mayberry. So that was the town in which Andy Griffith was born. I created this slide here because, you know, there was a role for a young aspiring lawyer in that show, but they got cut. So there's no Landon in the Andy Griffith show. But that certainly, that town's kept some of its charm. And so I went from small town in North Carolina to small town here, and I'm glad to be here working with everyone.
Yeah, and we're really lucky to have Landon as part of our team at the law office. He brings a great energy to it, great knowledge, and does a great job with our clients in the servicing. So, you know, as I said, we work together as a team, so not unusual that if you called and ask a question, it might be me that gets back to you, it might be a support staff person, or it might be Landon. What we want to do is make sure that we get back to you as soon as possible in a most complete answer. At our firm, there is Landon and I, but there's also Brittany Smith, who's another attorney who's been here for quite a while. Jenna Franks, who's just about to go out on maternity leave. We're really happy for her as she welcomes her second child into her family. Amos Goodall, who, you know, Amos and Kathleen were originally partners in the state college office when our law offices merged. And Kathleen Yurchak, who does a lot of estate administration and litigation in the state college office. So let's talk about some things that we need to think about updating, changing for a review. The first thing we want to talk about is long-term care planning. And, you know, unfortunately, this is something that we talk about because the cost of long-term care can be quite high. We worry about, you know, working our whole lives, getting prepared for long-term care, and then having the cost of long-term care really compromise our expenses, compromise what our money that we have amassed for our retirement years or for inheritance for our children. As people live longer, this becomes a bigger and bigger issue. For some people, people on here, you may have done trusts where we took assets and we put them into a trust that started a 5-year look back period to protect against the cost of long-term care. And that's something that it's legal to do. It's able to be done. And it's something that when we're on a review appointment, sometimes we want to look at it and say, well, did we put enough into the trust? Or do we want to put more into the trust? So sometimes what happens is we put money into a trust, but then people don't spend their money and it keeps accumulating. For some of you on here, we may not have used a trust. We may have talked to you about long-term care insurance or using some sort of a hybrid plan that helps protect against the cost of care. That would be individual to you, but the cost of care is something that's important that we think about and continue thinking about. The average cost of nursing home care in Pennsylvania right now is $10,000. The average cost for assisted living or personal care is between $5,000 and $9,000 a month. And that's really one of the big issues is, you know, the amount that that cost is, you know, in 10 months at a nursing home, there goes $10,000. And so we want to think about it. So what we do at our office is we think about what is the process? What should we do to make sure that our assets are protected? And that could be by buying a financial product. It also could be by using a trust. Now, we got a really good question. I'm going to answer the questions that were submitted ahead of time, hopefully kind of in the order that we talk about things. So one of the questions that we got, which I thought was wonderful, it says, in trying to finance the huge cost of protecting our economy due to this current challenge, so I think the person is talking about, given all of the stimulus packages that are being given out there, could the federal government change the Medicaid look back for a protector trust from 5 to 7 years? And could that have affected those of us that have already activated and funded our protector trust? So it's a great question. Clearly, there will be changes. Changes in income tax structures, maybe changes to look back periods, maybe changes to the federal estate tax exemption. You know, given the amount of money that's being given out for our government, there will be some response. And so I think it's important that we all think about that and know that we may have to make changes based on those responses. But please be comfortable in the fact that if you've already done your planning, even if in the future they say they change it to a 7-year look back, you would be grandfathered in. So if you did your trust, let's say in 2017, and you had a five-year look back, and let's say in 2021 they made a change, that change would not apply to your 2017 trust. And so you can rest assured that that wouldn't happen. I'm not really good at predicting if I think it will happen. I can still remember my career when there was a three-year look back and it went to 5 years. There was a part of me that would say, oh, I don't think they'd go to 7 years. But I have to say, look back seem to be something that they do consider at this point in time. We've seen it happen in the last year with veterans benefits. So I couldn't say it's not a possibility. But one of the things that you would think about is looking at your own individual plan, and you would want to think about, have I put enough into the trust, or should I fund it more now because there could be potential changes to the law? Now, usually we would know about those changes. In most of my career, we've often had time to know. You kind of hear them talking about it, and we would have time to alert you. Unfortunately, with the last couple of law changes, large law changes, they've happened relatively quickly, and we haven't been given that time. So that's something that if you're concerned about, you know, I would suggest that you think about looking at your individual situation, updating your amount of assets, and thinking, do I have enough protected or not? Now, not everybody on this call has a protector trust. Some of you have revocable living trusts that don't offer protection from nursing homes, but some of you do have protector trusts or income-only protector trusts. Any trust that has the word protector in it has some ability to protect against the cost of long-term care, and that's really what we're talking about here. So I think that's I thought that was a really great question. And again, what will be the response? I'm not sure, but we'd all be very naive not to think that there's not going to be some response. You know, I think for some of you, where we've done federal estate tax planning and that exemption has went up to, you know, over $11 million, and it's supposed to sunset in 2025, there's a question, you know, will they let it sunset now? And that means that the threshold will be lower for people to pay federal estate taxes. That's something that if you had an estate of 5, 6, 7, 8 million, that's something we should be looking very closely at and tracking. Now, we won't know until 2025, and that's a long way from here, but not really. So we need to know that this pandemic will affect our tax laws, and it will affect laws on the transfers of assets because it's a way for the government to gather money. Not right, not wrong. It just is a fact. It is a way for them to gather money, and often something that they look at taxing. In fact, in a little bit, we're going to talk about the SECURE Act, and that SECURE Act is exactly that. It's a law that Landon's going to talk about that is really designed to try to help tax some of this transfer of money. And so that's an example of a law that was passed. And we see these laws passed both under Democrats and Republicans to think that, you know, because some political party is in power that it won't happen. That's not what I can see as I look back on history. There's certainly some law change, there's some preferences of law changes held by Democrats versus Republicans, but the fact that the law may change to tax income or the transfer of wealth, I think that can happen in either party. So great question and great things for you to be thinking about in your own individual situation as we move on from there. Now, before Landon gets to the SECURE Act, I do just want to talk a little bit about COVID-19 and your personal planning and how that may have changed. So for you on the call, we hadn't really planned to talk about like powers of attorneys and those types of things, because quite honestly, the law hasn't really changed a huge amount, and you probably wouldn't need to make changes to them. These are foundational documents that honestly, you probably can't get out of your office without me doing for you, because I believe so strongly that everybody should have a power of attorney. It's basically a document that says, if you can't make your own decisions, this is who you want to make it. So for most of you on here, you're gonna have a financial power of attorney, a healthcare power of attorney, maybe a mental health power of attorney, and even a living will that talks about end of life decisions. The law is probably not going to require, unless you did them prior to 2015, you know, they're probably okay. However, we want to think about some things that are already coming up because of COVID-19. The first is more now than any other time in my career, we see where if somebody's been appointed an agent and they're not able to act. So we just had a situation where one of our clients was being admitted to a nursing home, and that client wasn't able, that client appointed their daughter to be their agent to sign the paperwork. And that agent couldn't do that because they were in isolation because of COVID-19. So in that situation, we needed to go on to the next person. And the document was well written as far as allowing that to happen, because the document says, you can use my alternate or successor agent in the event that I'm unable or unwilling to act. So we could say, well, this person's not able to act because they're in isolation. So one of the things we'd want to look at your documents and say is, do we have enough alternate agents? You know, do we have enough people who are, can stand in line and make those decisions? So really important. The other thing I'll give you is just a kind of a practical tip. It's an odd time right now where people aren't able to visit in nursing homes and hospitals. In my own family, I've had an admission into a personal care home. It's hard to do an admission at that point in time. One of the things I would suggest to you is if you were to be ill for any reason, or if you were to get COVID-19, my suggestion for you is to go ahead and pack a bag. Kind of like I remember doing when I was pregnant with my three kids, and you get close to the due date and you got the bag there ready to go. And this is kind of a real practical thing, because if I go to the hospital, you know, what we usually do is we rush to the hospital, we go to the ER, and then our family members can come back and bring us the stuff we need. Well, that's hard now because family members are not allowed to visit in most facilities. And so we want to be able to have that stuff ahead of time. So if I got COVID-19 or I was going to have something, what is it that I need? Do I need my phone? Do I need an extra charger? Would I want to read a book? I know it has nothing to do with your estate planning, but again, we end up working with a lot of people that are in crisis. We end up talking to facilities, and we're seeing this as an issue, that you can't just rush into the ER, be admitted to the hospital, and then your family brings your stuff. Of course, they can drop it off later, but the ability to communicate with each other is not what it was before. So if you're concerned about that at all, go ahead and pack a bag and think about it as we used to do when we were all ready to have our babies, if we're women, or the men who had to take the bag with us to make sure. So I think that that's important. I think, you know, a lot of what I end up doing is thinking about how can we help people who are in facilities who now can't visit? How can we, you know, where, you know, I'm trying to, you know, make sure there's extra puzzles and extra things to do. So again, your legal documents don't need to be changed, but the reality of needing care is a little different right now. It feels a little different. I also, and this will be my last thing, Landon, and then I'll turn it over to you. I also would urge everybody to seek medical care when you need it. There is a lot that I'm reading right now about people who are not seeking medical care, maybe for a heart attack or something like that. And that is making it so that their situation becomes more difficult. I can't talk to the prevalence of COVID-19 in our local facilities. I, of course, listen to Dr. Levine. I think Pennsylvania's Department of Health website is really well done. But it's disturbing to me to find clients that are not receiving care or getting care because they're afraid of going to the ER. Of course, balance your powers, balance your issues, and make whatever decision you want. But if you're having a heart attack, delaying treatment is harmful. And so I urge you to go out and get that treatment. Again, just a byproduct that we're seeing. So with that, when you think about your plan, we talked about long-term care planning, and that's a big issue in the second half of life, something we'll always have to think about. We don't want our retirement savings depleted by inadvertent cost of care. But how that gets paid for in the future is going to be impacted by COVID-19 and the access to funds. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Landon to talk about the SECURE Act, which was a huge law change and one of those changes that came relatively suddenly that I was talking about at the end of last year. And then when he's done, I will talk about some of the, we got quite a few questions specifically to this, and I'll talk about that and talk about some case scenarios. So over to you, Landon.
All right. Thank you, Julie. So yeah, Let's change subjects for a minute and talk about retirement plans and income tax. So as Julie mentioned, the SECURE Act was part of a law passed late last year. I believe it was in December last year that this law passed, and it took effect on January 1st. So obviously, attorneys' offices like ours, financial planners, accountants, did not have much time to get our minds around it. And then also on the other side, let our clients know what's going on. So I'm glad that you all joined us here so that we can talk about this, try to get that information out there. But so the changes that happened with SECURE Act, so the SECURE Act affected any of your retirement plans, so both IRAs and Roth IRAs. But I'm going to narrow the focus of my discussion to traditional IRAs because while the same rules do apply for Roth IRAs, there's not those income tax considerations attached to it. So if as I go through this, know that it applies to Roth IRAs, but of course, once you take a distribution from a Roth IRA, you're not going to be taxed on it in the same way. So it's the consequences aren't as important as they are for a traditional. So there's two ways to categorize the changes made. One is the way that it affects you now. So anyone that has an IRA right now, there are some of the changes that would affect that might affect the way it's treated right now. But then the big change happened after you pass away and how that IRA is treated once it's received by your beneficiaries. So this slide here starts with the first part of that. So people with existing IRAs who are currently living. So one of the changes was that the required minimum distributions now start at age 72. So for a little bit of background there, for those of you who are not familiar, required minimum distributions are distributions from your IRAs that you're forced to take by law that are based on your life expectancy when they start. The old rules started at 70 and a half. So once you turned 70 and a half, the IRS would say that you have to take a certain amount of your IRA and withdraw it. And, you know, why do they do that? Well, of course, once you withdraw from an IRA, you pay income tax on that distribution. So this is another way for them to get income tax for money that you have set aside and not paid taxes on for all this time. So one of the changes was simply changing that age from 70 and a half to 72. And so what that means for you is that you're able to take an extra year and a half of the tax-free growth that can happen within an IRA or a Roth IRA. But then of course, once you turn 72 and you are required to take those distributions, then you've got a larger pool to pull from. So you might wanna talk to your financial planner about the best way to approach this, but know that you're not gonna be forced to take any RMDs until 72. And then, under the old rules, there was also a cap. So at age 70 and a half, under the old rules, once your RMDs kick in and you're forced to take distributions, under the old rules, you were no longer allowed to contribute to your IRAs past that age. But now, as long as you're still working, you can still contribute to an IRA past that age to take advantage of those tax-free contributions to the IRAs. Just know that at 72, it will be coming back. And eventually some of that's going to be taxable when they make you take it. Another change that happened with this law that's probably more relevant for people who are starting their careers or earlier in their careers, but now long-term and part-time employees are eligible to enroll in their company's 401k retirement plans. And so just a little bit of definitions there. Part-time employees that would qualify for this, you know, that's not somebody who works just a few hours a week here and there. It's anybody who works at least 1,000 hours in 1 year. And then likewise, on the flip side of that, a long-term employee is someone who may not work as many hours a year, but they are there long-term. So if you work at least 500 hours a year for three consecutive years, you would meet that long-term employee definition. So those new employees were previously not eligible to enroll in companies' 401k plans, but now they are. So if you or any of your anybody in your family meets one of, you think might meet one of these definitions and is interested in retirement saving, which is advisable for anyone. This is something, certainly something to look into, because it's a great way to set money aside for retirement. But so those are the big changes that happened while that affect current retirement plans while you're still alive. The most important change, because this looks fairly good for you, so you know you're able to take advantage of a longer period of tax-free growth. So the question is then, why did the government do this? You know, what's in it for them? Well, you'll see there at the very bottom line is that they are putting the brunt of the fundraising motive of this on your beneficiaries. So now, once the owner of an IRA passes away, once their beneficiaries receive the inherited IRA, they must take the entire value of the retirement account within 10 years from the time that you passed away. So they're able to take that in equal 1/10 portions, such that at the end of 10 years, it's paid, or they can delay it and structure it however they want. But they really do have 10 years to take out the entire IRA, meaning that if you pass away with a traditional IRA in your name, with some exceptions that I'll touch on here in a minute, but in most cases, 100% of that IRA is going to be taxable income for someone within 10 years of your death. So let's dig into that a little bit more here. Next slide, please. There we go. So one way, of course, to make sure that no one's going to get hit with income tax from this is to make qualified charitable distributions. So now this is one that if you don't need those RMDs, you know, your financial advisor is telling you that you have to start taking these distributions, you don't need it, and you would rather just not have that extra income. You can make qualified charitable distributions that go such that your RMD goes directly to a charity as soon as it's payable to you. As long as it doesn't touch your hands, it would not be even included in your adjusted gross income, which is that AGI. So on a separate note for just a second, so if we talk about any acronyms that you're not familiar with, please do raise your hand and ask a question so that we can address that later. This area of law is an alphabet soup of acronyms. The last thing I want to do is lose you because I use an acronym that you may not be familiar with. So you see on this slide, AGI, that's adjusted gross income, basically what you're taxed on. So if you don't need your RMDs, one way to fulfill all the requirements of required minimum distributions without having that tax hit on yourself, that can go straight to a charity. All right, and then, so one question we commonly get about this is, does this 10-year distribution schedule apply when the beneficiary of an IRA is your estate, or is it a 5-year schedule? So if the beneficiary of your IRA is your estate, then you've got a 5-year schedule of distribution. Now, for a multitude of other reasons, I would not recommend your estate being the beneficiary of your IRA, because that would make it that would make the IRA eligible for your creditors, or if there's any liens against your estate, and it would make it subject to probate. And then on top of all of those reasons, you're also going to be on a 5-year repayment schedule, which of course increases your annual your beneficiary's annual taxable liability from it. Okay, and so here is a little bit of math for you, because I'm sure some of you are unlike me at least, and aren't intimidated by a spreadsheet full of numbers. But for those of you who like to see the numbers we've got here, so this is a spreadsheet showing the stretch. So whenever you say the stretch in this area of tax law, at least, under the old rules, when a beneficiary received an IRA, the required minimum distributions that they were allowed to take was determined based on their life expectancy. So in the very middle column there, you see LE factor. That's life expectancy factor. So in this example, someone passed away on December 31st with $1 million IRA. Their beneficiary of that IRA was a 45-year-old, we'll say it was a child. Under the IRS's table, so that LE factor is not anything that we make up. That comes directly from the IRS's tables. Based on your age, they can tell you what your life expectancy is. Take it with a grain of salt as far as your own personal health, but they'll give you a number. But basically, that 45-year-old would be able to stretch that out over the course of their life expectancy, which the IRS would say is just under 39 years. So their required minimum distribution in that first year, so this is 2019 under this example, they would have to take out $25,000, which would be taxable income. But if the market does well that year and you get 7% growth in that IRA, on the right column there, you're still seeing that they made, there's a $42,000 growth in there, which is still happening tax-free. So you'll see under the old numbers that the RMDs were a lot lower. And if as long as the stock market was doing well, there was still the opportunity to get more growth than what you were paying in RMDs. Now on the next slide here, it shows this, let's see here. Oh, sorry. So the next slide is an example of the different individual income tax brackets. So, let's see here. Yeah, that looks right. So as those taxes come in, you're taxed at these rates. So as you can see, and part of the planning here is that as you're thinking about the beneficiaries of your IRAs, then you know, one thing to think about with the Secure Act changes is your beneficiaries' tax brackets. You know, if you have beneficiaries that have traditionally very high paying jobs and you think that they're in one of these higher tax brackets, just know that if you give them your IRAs, those RMDs as they come in are going to be taxed at whatever their individual bracket is. So if you're weighing on how to distribute different assets in your estate, it might be advisable to use your retirement assets for beneficiaries who might be in a lower tax bracket. Okay, let's go on to the next slide here. All right, and so one of the examples I touched on earlier, so earlier I said that whenever a beneficiary receives inherits an IRA, it's under most circumstances that's going to be received as required minimum distributions within 10 years. Now, the exceptions to that are eligible designated beneficiaries. And so this works, of course, if you have one of these accepted persons directly identified as the beneficiary on the account, or if you have a trust under which one of these persons is a direct designated beneficiary. And so these exceptions are the surviving spouse. So if you have an IRA and your spouse is your beneficiary, or a trust for the benefit of your spouse, which for those of you who have income only protector trusts through our office, there are provisions in there that make the surviving spouse the designated beneficiary of all RMDs coming from that account. So that would qualify for a lifetime stretch out based on the surviving spouse's lifetime instead of just 10 years. A minor child is a exception to this as well. Now that's not as comprehensive as the surviving spouse. So that minor child would be exempted from the 10-year stretch out until they reach the age of majority. And now majority in this is not as strict as some other laws, and it's not just a strict age 18. It's based on a variety of factors, such as if they're still in school, and where if they're living with you, those sorts of things. So that's the number that is really best determined on a case-by-case basis. Now, a disabled individual is an eligible designated beneficiary. And going along with that, so the rule of thumb with disabled individuals is that if they're disabled under Social Security regulations, so if they're eligible to receive Social Security disability or SSI, they would meet this definition, which means that most, at least in our office, supplemental needs trusts for the benefit of a specific individual who's disabled would qualify for a stretch of RMDs based on that person's life expectancy, not 10 years. And then also chronically ill individuals, that's a much more nebulous definition, but that's what another one that might be best determined on the facts of any individual case. But just know that if you have a beneficiary that you think might be chronically ill, that's worth discussing with us or with your financial planners. And then also an individual not more than 10 years younger than the employee. And so that would be if you have a friend or something that's 5 years younger than you, you could give it to them and they would qualify for the lifetime stretch.
So, I think a lot of this I'll kind of sum up for some people. And I think the way I think about it when the SECURE Act changed was, how does this affect our different clients? So, when we did planning and you could give over your IRA to your children and they could take it out across their life expectancy, or to their grandchildren and they could take it out across their life expectancy, they could really stretch it out. And so if I had even $1 million IRA and I had to stretch that out over, 30 years, the amount of money that I'm taking out in a year isn't a lot. When I stretch that down, compact that down to you have to take it out over 10 years, what happens is, the children are getting more money out faster and therefore they're going to pay higher income tax rates. So it kind of compounds the problem. It's very different to take out $30,000 a year versus taking out $100,000 and how that's taxed. So when we think about it, I think about it, across the different clients that we serve. So first of all, estate administration. So, as Landon said, this came in December and all of a sudden in January, we're having people that unfortunately are passing away. We can't redo their planning, but now we have to think about, is there something that we should do differently? So typically, if like a husband passed away, we really want most, if not all of that IRA money to go to the spouse, let the spouse use it. And then when that person dies, their children could take it out over their life expectancy. One of the things that this law did was make us look at that differently. So, now if a spouse passes away, we want to think about, should we just claim any of this down to a child right now so that they can start a 10-year rule on some of the money, wait until the spouse passes away, and then have another 10-year rule on a different amount of the money? So, for instance, just to give you an example, if somebody passed away and let's say they had $1 million in their IRA, just to use a round number, historically, we would have just had that go to the spouse, have the spouse use what they need upon their death, then have that pass out to the kids. But remember, what this new law means is that the kids are going to have to take that $1 million over 10 years, $100,000 a year. Now, depending on your kids' situation, what their occupation is, what their tax bracket is, whether or not that's really a big issue. Today, we would look at that same client and say, okay, if dad passed away, does mom really need the $1 million? If she does, she should get it. There's no doubt about that. But what if she says, given the other things I have, I'm not really going to use this money. We might want to disclaim, let's say half of it, let's say $500,000 down to the kids. They then can take that over their life. They could then can take that over 10 years. So $50,000 a year. Mom has the other $500,000. And when she passes away, that then can go on to the kids. So what we're doing is really creating two different 10-year life choices. And that's something we standardly do now when we're doing estate administration in response to this change. For those of you who are long-term care plans, your big issue was worrying about nursing home care. Maybe you have a house and a couple $100,000. I don't think that this really will affect you all that much. Because, you know, 10 years is still a pretty long period of time. And so if you have a $200,000 IRA, it has to come out in 10 years, that's $20,000 a year. Not what we want, but, you know, it's not going to probably jump your kids into another tax bracket. And so may not really need to do very much. If you're somebody on here who has, we've done special needs planning for, so you have a child who has special needs, they're one of the eligible designated beneficiaries. And so we might want to change not how much they get, but actually, if I had three kids, one who's a beneficiary who has special needs, I might want to give more of my IRA money to that kid and give other money to my other children and equalize that in whatever way. So that's something that, you know, because my child who has special needs might not have a high tax bracket, that's, you know, affecting this. For those of you who we kind of talk about wealth protection planning clients, they're clients who, you know, and many of you on here are in this category who you've amassed a good amount of wealth. You might have a good amount of money sitting in an IRA. This is something we have to really think about in your situation. Do you want to make changes? Do you not? We want to think about the tax brackets of your kids. So I know I have some clients on here that their tax brackets of their kids are quite high. And should we then take action now during our lives to change some of this? And even with some of the laws I'm going to get into, you might have a trust that we need to change because you it's a little more complex type of thing about whether or not it's a conduit or an accumulation trust that I'll talk about. But you're definitely somebody we want to talk to. And we're going to talk at the end, we're going to talk about, you know, a lot of people are talking about Roth conversions. I'm not really excited about Roth conversions, and I'll kind of explain why. We also have some clients that are doing charitable remainder trusts, which are very exciting to me. Now, every person that you interact with, every professional, they always have biases, but we're going to kind of go through some of that to kind of have you see how that will impact you, you know, kind of going forward. I want to get to some questions, though. So before I get into that, I want to address some of the questions that came in. I have to tell you guys, you guys gave very good questions. I had to research one or two of these. I will give you the really lawyer answer, which is it depends. the first question asks, at this point, the federal government has declared the IRA minimum required distributions for seniors older than 70 and a half to be waived for 2020. If the stock, so that means that you don't have to take your RMDs in 2020. If the stock market was to rebound significantly yet this year, is it possible, in parentheses, not likely, that this rule could be withdrawn and at the end of 2020, seniors are again required to make distributions again? It is possible. This is not something that would be grandfathered in because you would still have time to make a change. But I have to tell you, it's highly unlikely. I do not think that that would happen. I know we are in strange times, uncharted waters, definitely. But I don't think that will happen. Another question kind of builds on that, you know, what happens if I do waive it and I don't take it this year? It doesn't necessarily adversely affect your divisor, your RMDs coming out, but remember your RMDs will be more, because you left that money in there. And that had to do with, you know, this chart that Landon was talking about. If you see, like, historically with RMDs, if I have start with $1 million balance, even when I'm taking my RMDs, and these are the divisors that we're talking about, you'll see that, you know, in this situation, my IRA is still growing. So even with RMDs and stretching, now this is an example of somebody inheriting it, but the same holds true. So what's going to happen is my balance is going to go up, making my RMD higher. So as you move forward on that. Okay. Next question is, can I get back an RMD that I've already taken back? This is the question that we have to say, it depends, the real attorney answer. The answer to that is not really. You really can't put back in an RMD. But interestingly, there are two ways to correct that maybe this year if you've done that. So if you've taken out an RMD and you want to put it back in, first, You know, anytime you take something out of your IRA, you have 60 days where you can roll it into another IRA. So if you've taken out your RMD and you're still within that 60-day period, you could put it back in. That's an interesting thought. Also, right now, given this year, you could classify it as a coronavirus-related contribution, and that you may allow you to put that back in. I have to tell you, not all the guidance is out about that, but if I was looking for a way to put my RMD back in and I was outside the 60-day rule, that's the way I would try to do it, is I would classify it as a coronavirus-related contribution, distribution, and you are able to put those back in. Now, again, as with so many laws right now, they are passing laws and then they don't pass the regulation. So we kind of know what they mean, but not. But I did want to share that the answer to that is that it is maybe possible. And that's something that I'd be happy to follow up with individually, whoever was asking that question. But I thought that was a really good question. The next question is, are taxpayers who don't itemize deductions eligible to take a $300 for donations in 2020? The answer to that is yes. So that's something that's come out. So for many years, many of us itemize our deduction. In the last few years, many of us are not itemizing our deductions because the standard deduction went up so much. And so I bet you, many of you that are sitting here maybe 5 years ago did itemize and now aren't. One of the new law changes is that we are eligible, even if we don't itemize, to deduct $300 in donations to a charity in 2020. So money I give to a church, a nonprofit, money I would give to a food bank right now, you are able to deduct that even if you don't itemize. Now, it's only up to $300, but it's kind of like, I know many of you on here probably make more than $300, and so you're going to get that extra deduction on your tax return. But just know that that's out there. If you haven't, and maybe you've stopped doing some of your donations, or stop keeping track of them, keeping receipts and those types of things because you're relying on the standard deduction, you would want to keep the receipts for up to $300 in cash donations. So a lot going on here. So some of this that I'm talking about and answering these questions have to do with the SECURE Act. And some of them are legislation that's been passed in response to the coronavirus. And this is one of those. The $300 is a legislation that's been passed in regards to the coronavirus. And I think I answered all those questions. So for those of you who are sitting on here, and many of you are, who have a revocable living trust, there could be some changes that we need to make. Not difficult changes, but changes we want to think about. So I'm going to kind of go through that. There's really two types of trusts. One's a conduit trust. So many of you know that my husband does excavating. Whenever I think of a conduit trust, I think of conduit pipe. It means it goes through, it travels through. So conduit means that it goes through. That's one type of trust. That means that if something goes into it, like an RMD, it's going to travel through that trust and be distributed out to your beneficiaries. So if I had a conduit trust, my RMD paid into it, let's say I passed away, the RMD paid into it, it would, as a conduit, it would go right out to those beneficiaries. The other type of trust is an accumulation trust. An accumulation trust means it doesn't necessarily pass right out, it accumulates within the trust. Now, what we chose to do in your situation may have been based on what you wanted to do. So for instance, I know I worked with many people who made their grandchildren beneficiaries of their IRAs and not their kids. And we used a trust and we wanted it to accumulate. We wanted it to continue to grow. That was the whole point. And in this situation, that could be a little burdensome from a tax standpoint. Now, again, I'm making some general statements because it really depends, is your IRA 100,000 or is it a million? But it's something that is worthwhile looking into. So just to, I gave you kind of an overview. Now I'm going to kind of walk through the steps. So this is a conduit trust, and you see on the pictures, the IRA is there, it goes into the trust, and it really goes right back out to the beneficiaries. So pre-2020, so before this, that was a great thing to do. We would have it pay out based on the life expectancy of a single beneficiary. The trustee got the RMD and gave it to the person they're supposed to. That still works if we have eligible designated beneficiaries that we can go through the trust. Doesn't work as well if they're not eligible beneficiaries. And I'll just go back to, these are the eligible designated beneficiaries. So a surviving spouse, no problem. A minor child, that is your child, not a minor grandchild, interestingly. I will tell you the rules of a minor child are interesting. A minor child means a child up to the age of 26. As long as they're still in school. So I have a 24-year-old daughter. She's graduated from Northeastern. She's not considered a minor child because she's not in school. If she would go back to some other school, she would then be considered a minor child. That's an odd definition of minor child, but they're kind of playing off of healthcare definitions. A disabled child or chronically ill. What we don't see here is who your most of your beneficiaries are, and that's an adult child. So for an adult child, what's going to happen is it's going to come out in 10 years. The trust doesn't harm it, doesn't make it any better. It's again, that 10-year rule. So here's what's happening is we have to distribute, you know, after 2020, we have to distribute that out all in 10 years. A conduit Q-tip. So a Q-tip is a qualified terminal interest. That's we use in a spousal situation. So some of you have Q-tip trusts that have been funded. That is for a spouse. That's okay. It's where the children come in that can be a possible disaster in that situation. Accumulation trust, again, pre-2020, what we had was the life expectancy of the oldest beneficiary. So the IRA would go in, it could accumulate and stay in that trust. And you'll see there's just a dotted line to the beneficiary here. It means it doesn't have to come out. The trustee had discretion. That worked quite well. Right now, we have a 10-year rule. So what means is happened is it's going into the trust faster. What's happening here is if it accumulates, and this is the hardest part, if it accumulates right here, we're going to probably be taxed at a pretty high rate, 37%. So if you did a trust that we held the money in to let it accumulate because we wanted to benefit maybe grandchildren, that's something we're going to really have to look at in your individual situation because it may not make sense because we're getting this higher tax rate here. So that's just something we need to be looking at. Now, for a lot of clients, one of the things that I've done for many years is charitable remainder trust. We do those for federal estate tax planning for many years. And it's definitely a tool that comes out to be helpful right now for this type of thing. So if I was sitting on this call and I had a lot of IRA money and I had children who were in higher tax brackets, it is worthwhile to think about a charitable remainder trust. What I'm doing right now, I just talked to a client the other day, lovely individual, he's in that situation. And so we're just doing some samples of what would a charitable remainder trust look like. But essentially, a charitable remainder trust doesn't pay federal taxes on an IRA distribution or the growth. And you can design like a fixed amount. So what happens is, let's say again, in this scenario, there's $1 million in an IRA. We put that into the trust. The children get a lifetime beneficial interest in it. Let's say that they get 5% for their life. So they get $50,000 a year. And upon their death, the remainder goes to charity. That is a way to take money that would have went in income tax to the federal government and end up giving it to a charity at the end. And a lot of times when we do these scenarios, we have a program where we do it, what we find is the kids are still getting $1 million and the charity is getting money. And what we've done is made it so that the government didn't get as much income tax money. So these are things I'm really familiar with. We've done them for years for different reasons. I've not typically done them for income tax reasons. Usually it was federal estate tax reasons that we did them. But I find this to be really interesting. And that's something, you know, what would happen is that process, you have to be willing, you know, I feel like it's something people need to know about, and how exactly it works will depend on how old your kids are, how long we want to do it. And so we like to do a scenario. So Chrissy, my paralegal, and I just worked the other day on a scenario that we're going to be showing one of our clients so they can kind of get more information about it. This is something that works really great right now too, on the phone or via Zoom, because it's not something I think you should rush into. But it is something I think you should learn a little bit about and think about, does it make a difference in your situation? I know in the client I'm talking about, you know, he's a physician, retired. It was one of the things I love about my job is I love talking to you guys as clients. I love getting his input on the COVID-19. But, you know, in that situation, we needed to look at his situation, and he has children who are in high tax brackets, and it's going to make sense in his situation. Now, it's totally up to him whether he does it or not. You know, there are other things that we could do, but it is definitely something that I think is worth people's time. I don't think you hear a lot of people talking about it because not a lot of people have done charitable remainder work. Earlier in my career, I had a lot of very charitable-minded clients, and so that's why we started doing it. Also, when the exclusion for federal estate tax was like $3 million, I had quite a few clients that could take advantage of this. So the other thing I want to comment on is, you know, the Roth distribution. So you also can convert to a Roth. So sometimes if, let's say, again, you're in a situation where you say, you know what, Julie, this is something that would affect my family and how much they end up keeping. So I want to think about this. There's a lot of people that are talking about Roth conversions, and I'm going to go through some case studies. And the case study is not to say whether or not you should do a Roth conversion. The case study is to show that it's probably better off to do it once and done. I have a lot of people that are suggesting to my clients, a lot of other advisors suggesting to my clients that they should do it over a period of years. And the reason they're doing that is if you do it over a period of years, your tax bracket could be lower. And I agree with that. But there's unintended consequences. If I take money out of my IRA, pay the taxes on it to convert it to a Roth, it is true, if I take less money out every year, I might be in a lower tax bracket. But what happens is that makes my Social Security taxable. So if I did it 1 year, then my Social Security is all taxable that year. If I do it over 10 years, then it's taxable over 10 years. Now you may say, Julie, that's okay because mine's taxable anyways. But the other thing is the Medicare premium. So how much you pay for your Medicare is a direct result of what your income was last year. So if you do it all in 1 year, your Medicare premium will just go up for 1 year. But if you do it for 8 years, for instance, it's going to go up for 8 years. And there's a huge difference. You could be paying, you could be paying $150 a month for your Medicare premium, or it can go up to $500 a month. So just think about, if I do this, and an unintended consequences is that I have to pay $4,000 more money every year for my Medicare, you know, multiply that times 8 years, that's $32,000. So make sure if you do a Roth conversion that the person that you talk to understands these unintended consequences and that they've been taken into consideration. It's not just your income tax bracket. It's these things. And so here's just an example I did. It's funny, I had a student from Bloomsburg who's in accounting, kind of crunched some of these numbers. I can't tell you they're 100%, but they get the point across. So in this situation, we have parents, they pass away with $4 million. In the IRA, each kid gets $2 million. So in this situation, there's two kids. Well, again, prior to the SECURE Act, that would have paid out across the kid's life expectancy. So they would have had less money every year. Now we know they have to pay out over 10 years. So that kid, each kid is going to put $200,000 on their tax return every year for 10 years if we do nothing. So in this situation, we have kid one, 30 years old, makes $30,000 a year. Kid two is 35, makes $125. And, you know, this was just, you know, to give a scenario. So parents make $7,000 a year and, you know, no really earned income. And so they say, well, I don't want my kids to have to pay all these taxes. So I want to convert my regular IRA into a Roth. And if we crunch those numbers, what we see is that the cost to do that over 8 years, which would be $500,000 a year, is really almost the same as doing it all in 1 year. So that's the point. Don't do a Roth conversion unless the person that you're talking to has factored in the cost of the taxation of your Social Security and your increased Medicare premium. And so that's an important thing for we think about. So I think that that, again, I'm just responding to people are calling my office saying, hey, I'm going to do these conversions. And I'm like, Also, you know, you have to take into account what's happening with the stock market. And, you know, where's the flexibility of that or where is that going to fall? So if you're sitting there thinking, wow, okay, I might need to change my trust, but I also want to think about, should I just let my IRA go and my kids have to get it over 10 years and that's fine and they're going to pay more income tax? That's certainly an okay choice. That's your choice. But some other things that people are talking about doing is one, buying life insurance. You know, that's definitely something that has been out there to replace taxation. You certainly could do that if you're a little younger. And remember, younger to me, my client's like 65. You know, if you're a little younger and you're in good health, that might be something we'd want to look into. I also like hybrid options. I would say to you, if you talk to anybody about life insurance, please make sure they're talking to you about hybrid options that would also pay for long-term care. And do not buy any life insurance, anything from somebody who doesn't know what the Pension Protection Act is. So if I was going to go down this road, I would want help with my long-term care. And there is beyond what I can get on this call. There's reasons that a Pension Protection Act policy makes a lot of sense. And I'm not saying from an investment standpoint, I'm saying from an attorney who understands taxation, it makes a lot of sense. Essentially, that type of policy, you put money in, and if you have to pull it out during your life to pay for long-term care, the thing we first started talking about, that $10,000 a month, you never pay the tax on it. So think about if I had $10,000 coming out of my IRA and I have to pay tax on it, or if I bring it out and I can pay directly to the nursing home with it and I don't have to pay tax, that's a huge leverage and advantage. And that's why you want to make sure if you do some type of product like that, that the person that you're talking to understands that and understands those rules out there. And I find some really do and I find some don't. I think that's important. So to kind of sum up the SECURE Act, you know, the big hit you at this point in time is the 10-year payout and looking at your individual situation to see if you want to address that during your life or if you don't want to. For many people, we should still look at your trust and make sure that you have you don't have an accumulation trust that is going to cause problems from a tax standpoint. Besides that, you can decide to do nothing. And there really wouldn't be any changes to your documents. So, you know, I always, this is a really old picture of my kids. My kids are now 24, 18, and 16, but I will always love this picture. And I think it's, you know, we don't know what's in store. And I think that's probably more true than ever. But you have, you know, I always feel an obligation to you because you've taken the time to put a plan in place. And one of the things I always want to make sure is that it's up to date when you go to use it. And that's really, really important. So at our office, as I talked about, this is what we usually talk about. I kind of talked about, you know, we have a team of attorneys, planners, certified Medicaid planners, and support staff who are knowledgeable. We really always wanted to have individualized planning for you. And as an attorney, it's important to me that the documents are very quality. And that we achieve peace of mind for you. But what I want to talk about is, you know, right now we're having some people saying, well, we can wait until this is over. I don't know when it's going to be over. And what I can say to you is that we've worked really hard to have appointments that are available by phone or video conference. So in phone, we can email you documents, review them on video conference. We can have the documents and share just like I'm sharing this PowerPoint. We are using Zoom technology. We may change that, but our provider says that it's fine the way that we use it with passwords and making sure things are protected. We never record client meetings. Our goal is really to give you the same service as face-to-face meetings. And unfortunately, even though COVID's going on, life marches on. So we're still having clients who are calling in their families who a loved one has passed away or gotten another diagnosis. We want to be able to be there to really help you. I also would let you know, we did get a waiver from the governor We are able to sign documents for end of life or crisis situation. So we are open for business remotely, but if there is a crisis, we can move forward with signing documents. We're also working on virtual notarization, but right now what we're doing is if you call to schedule a review appointment, what you can expect to happen to you, because I always want to know the process, like what would happen to me? How much time do I have to do this? Somebody would call you to gather updates to your asset list, because a lot of what we talked about, it depends to me, are your assets growing? Are they not? Should remember thinking about long-term care, should I put more money into my trust? Well, if your money's growing, we would want to think about that. And has anything really changed? And then you'd have a phone call or a Zoom. It's up to you, whatever you feel most comfortable. Where we review all of your documents and your plan. And that's always good for people. Sometimes people are like to me, I don't even remember what I did, Julie. And that's okay. It's good to like go back over. Some of you say, you know what, Julie, I really get it. I've talked to you enough. Don't bore me with that. But we want to make sure everybody thinks about that and gets an update on, you know, how you're feeling and your care. And then what we're doing is if we have that first appointment, just like we would have in person, and we decide that things need to be changed, then what we're doing is we're reviewing those documents via Zoom or email, sure everything's all correct. And then we would set up a signing appointment. And when it comes time for that signing appointment, we'll decide, do we want to go through with that signing? Or do we want to do it virtually? You know, but we want to be in the queue and ready in case there is a crisis that we can move forward. We are following Governor Wolf's stay-at-home order. We are not doing any things that we shouldn't be doing, but we do understand life goes on. And so we are doing signing available in your parking lot, as long as we've really reviewed all your documents ahead of time and you feel comfortable with them. We can have you sign them actually in your car. Or the law just changed in Pennsylvania, and we will be working on virtual notarizations. I will tell you, if we do virtual notarizations, I would probably want you, no extra charge, to come back later on and re-sign them. I worry that anything that you sign now virtually could be questioned by a bank or something down the road. But again, if you have a diagnosis or you say, Julie, I just want, you know, I'm a little anxious about everything that's going on and I want to make sure this gets done, we of course will go ahead. But we would have you probably come back later on and re-sign in person. So we really want to be here for you. You know, I hope, you know, we try to hit some high points. Individually, we would talk to people about other things. But the SECURE Act is a huge change. COVID-19 is a huge change. You know, we want you to reach out to us if there's any way that we can help you. We are here for you. We're trying to give out information on Facebook. We also do have a YouTube channel, and I've just started a Second Half of Life podcast to have people really think about things that are coming up within the second half of life. And I think I'm going to hand it over. Oh, I'm sorry. This is the Second Half of Life podcast. It will be on Apple, Spotify, and you can access it by getting on www.paeldercouncil.com/resource-centers/podcast. That's on our website. And if anybody needs that, we can of course send it out to you.